Chapter 12. A Green Baize Bookcase. Alexander always carried the works of Homer with him, in which he used to say he found every military expedient necessary to form his own troops for action. Thomas Webb, A Military Treatise. Crossing the Delaware River and defeating the Hessian garrison at Trenton greatly boosted the morale of the American troops, but Washington did not stop his winter offensive there. The following week he ordered another attack on British forces and successfully routed the enemy troops garrisoned at Princeton. In the face of Washington's aggressive tactics, Lord Howe consolidated the British garrisons in New Jersey and established winter quarters in New York City. Washington's army, in turn, went into winter quarters at Morristown, New Jersey. The following summer brought a new series of challenges once Lord Howe decided to lead his army from New York through New Jersey toward Philadelphia. By the end of August, Washington had repositioned the Continental Army to defend Philadelphia. On Tuesday, September 2, 1777, General Anthony Wayne wrote Washington to propose a strategic plan designed to preempt an enemy attack, suggesting that 3,000 of the best armed and disciplined Continental troops should hold themselves in readiness on the approach of the enemy to make a regular and vigorous assault on their right or left flank. This strategy, he argued, would be far better than waiting for the enemy to attack. Washington, who had much respect for General Wayne, seriously considered his suggestion. The two men had come to know one another the previous year. Having established himself as a local leader in revolutionary Pennsylvania politics, Wayne became a colonel in the Continental Army the first week of January 1776, commanding the 4th Battalion of the Pennsylvania Line. In mid-May, he joined Washington at New York, but quickly proceeded north to reinforce the Continental troops retreating from Canada. That winter, Wayne became commander of Fort Ticonderoga, an arduous assignment given the harsh weather conditions and meager supplies. Promoted to brigadier general in February, Wayne soon rejoined the main army in New Jersey. Given command of two brigades, he took the initiative and began plotting his strategy. After outlining his battle plan in the letter to Washington, Wayne described how his strategy would impact the British forces. Not only would a surprise attack startle the enemy troops, it would also prevent their advance and force them to retreat. Wayne was trying to impress Washington with his knowledge of military maneuvers. On several occasions already, Washington had encouraged his officers to study the art of war, or to use his words, to devote some part of your leisure hours to the study of your profession, a knowledge in which cannot be attained without application, nor any merit or applause to be achieved without a certain knowledge thereof. Clearly aware of the emphasis Washington placed on the study of military history and strategy, Wayne attempted to prove the efficacy of his plan with reference to historical precedent, going as far back as Julius Caesar's Gallic War to make his point. Besieged by the Gauls, Caesar, according to Wayne, sallied out with his cohorts and threw the Gauls into the utmost consternation and obtained an easy victory. Wayne did not stop with this example. Caesar had employed the same maneuver against the Gauls at Alesia with similar success. On both occasions, Caesar's unexpected attack surprised and terrorized the Gauls. To reinforce his argument, Wayne cited another leading authority, Marshal Saxe's Reveries, or Memoirs Concerning the Art of War. While Saxe's work underwent a reevaluation in the 19th century, Thomas Carlyle called it a strange military farrago, dictated, I should think, under opium, it was well respected in the 18th. Analyzing the psychological motivations of soldiers in battle, Saxe had said that an enemy's confused and frightened behavior in the face of a surprise attack proceeds from that consternation which is the unavoidable effect of sudden and unexpected events. Wayne's letter makes it seem as if he had a thorough understanding of the art and history of war, but his knowledge was more limited than it appears. Though he does not say so, the historical and theoretical basis for his planned attack came directly from Thomas Symes's Military Guide for Young Officers, a manual first published in London and republished in Philadelphia at the start of the Revolutionary War. Not only did Wayne take his general strategy from Symes, he also borrowed both his Caesar examples and his Marshal Saxe quotation from the same source. Having already received a presentation copy of the Philadelphia edition of Symes's Military Guide from publisher Robert Aiken, perhaps Washington realized that Wayne was cribbing from the work. Wayne's practical application of Symes's manual reveals the book's power. Military historian J. A. Holding calls Symes a long-winded drudge, but admits that the Military Guide presents the fullest collection of basic material on regimental administration and daily military activity to appear in English during the 18th century. Wayne never had the opportunity to carry out the strategy he took from Symes, but when Lord Howe's forces successfully attacked the Americans at the Battle of the Brandywine on September 11, 1777, Wayne and his troops maintained their position long enough to cover Washington's retreat. A few days later, Washington detached Wayne from the main army to harass the left flank of Lord Howe's forces as they advanced on Philadelphia. Anthony Wayne's experience reveals much about the place of military books on the battlefield during the Revolutionary War. He obviously kept a copy of Symes's Military Guide with him, read it carefully, and reread it as he shaped his combat strategy. By no means was Wayne alone. Other American officers took to heart Washington's advice to read military books. Captain Johann Ewald, a Hessian officer who served on the British side with the Field Jaeger Corps, recalled, "I was sometimes astonished when American baggage fell into our hands during that war to see how every wretched knapsack, in which were only a few shirts and a pair of torn breeches, would be filled up with military books." Seeing so many American knapsacks filled with so many military manuals, Captain Ewald made some general conclusions about the officers of the Continental Army, especially compared with their British counterparts. Ewald named the titles of a number of European military books he had found among the Americans, some of which turned up, by his estimate, 100 times. Impressed with their desire for knowledge on the battlefield, Ewald concluded that the American soldiers studied the art of war while in camp, which was not the case with the opponents of the Americans, whose portmanteaus were rather filled with bags of hair powder, boxes of sweet-smelling pomatum, cards instead of maps, and then often, on top of all, some novels or stage plays. Washington found out early the importance of military books for the field officer. While two classic works, Caesar's Commentaries and Quintus Curtius's History of the Wars of Alexander the Great, gave him a basic understanding of military tactics, biographies of more recent generals and commanders provided much additional information about the lives and decisions of famous officers. Historical works could only go so far. By the start of the Seven Years' War, Washington recognized serious gaps in his military knowledge and sought to deepen his knowledge of the art of war. In late 1755, some months after General Braddock's disastrous campaign against the French, Washington ordered a copy of Humphrey Bland's Treatise of Military Discipline. Already familiar with the work, Washington most likely ordered it to share with his regiment. An officer under the Duke of Marlborough, Bland later served as lieutenant colonel of the King's Regiment of Horse. He wrote his treatise during this service. From its initial publication in 1727 into the 1760s, it remained the standard manual of drill and discipline in the British Army. Bland's treatise was the Bible of the British Army. Major General James Wolfe, the renowned officer who had achieved victory over the French in Canada during the Seven Years' War, called it one of his favorite works. So well known was Bland's treatise that its author's name became synonymous with the book itself. During the middle third of the 18th century, to read Bland, or as it was sometimes called, Old Humphrey, was the duty of every young British officer. Washington had encountered Bland before he ordered his own copy in 1755. He may have read his brother Lawrence's copy. Young men with military ambitions often read Bland before they joined the army. In The Plain Dealer, to take an example from the stage, William Wycherley depicts a weedy youth named Jerry Blackacre, whose mother catches him reading a jest book. She suggests The Young Clerk's Guide instead. A grizzled veteran named Major Old Fox tells Jerry to read Bland, at which point the boy's mother exclaims, "Away with such trash! Do you want to send him to the devil headlong? I should have him teasing me tomorrow or the next day to buy him an ensign's commission. I would as lief he should read a play." As Mrs. Blackacre's words suggest, Bland could fire boyish imaginations and help young men foresee all sorts of military glory. The 1754 campaign against the French gave Washington another opportunity to encounter Bland's work. At Fort Necessity, at least one officer in the Virginia regiment had a copy of Old Humphrey with him. Left behind as a French hostage, Captain Robert Stobow kept the copy of Bland's treatise he had purchased in Williamsburg and carried it with him to Quebec City, where he was imprisoned. When he escaped from prison in 1757, he left the book behind. Perhaps he did not want any excess baggage slowing him down, or perhaps he did not need it anymore. After reading it countless times during his imprisonment, he must have had the book by heart. When Washington finally received the copy of Bland he had ordered in the spring of 1756, he was disappointed with it. A sixth edition of the work had appeared by this time, but the British merchant from whom Washington had ordered the book sent him the second edition, which was nearly 30 years old. This situation was not unprecedented or even unusual. London booksellers often foisted off copies of old editions onto colonial consumers, knowing full well that the width of the Atlantic effectively prevented them from returning unsatisfactory purchases. Sometimes British merchants had the audacity to overcharge for these out-of-date works. Well aware of this situation, Washington complained to his London agent, "'Tis a custom, I have some reason to believe, with many shopkeepers and tradesmen in London, when they know goods are bespoke for exportation, to palm sometimes old and sometimes very slight and indifferent goods upon us, taking care at the same time to advance 10, 15, or perhaps 20% upon them." Washington's writings verify that he was familiar with Bland even before his personal copy arrived. He expressed confidence in the work and recommended it to others. As commander of the Virginia Regiment in January 1756, he prepared an address to his officers containing some practical advice regarding how they should carry out their duties. He reminded them, "It is the actions and not the commission that make the officer." He also recommended they devote time to cultivating their military knowledge. "As we now have no opportunities to improve from example, let us read for this desirable end. There is Bland's and other treatises which will give the wished-for information." 2 years later, Washington wrote to Major Andrew Lewis, an officer under his command, reiterating his conviction that the major and his fellow officers should keep up with the latest military literature. He strongly emphasized the necessity of qualifying yourself by reading for discharging the duty of major, a post that requires a thorough knowledge of the service, and on the due execution of which your own, as well as the credit of your regiment, greatly depends. Serving under General John Forbes during the expedition against Fort Duquesne in late 1758, Washington received an object lesson in the practical value of books for military commanders. To cope with a French force much larger than his own, Forbes would establish a stockaded camp and blockhouse every 40 miles along his route. Forbes's strategy safely protected his troops, though it was both costly and time-consuming. General Forbes did have a precedent for his actions. His strategic approach follows the one Count Turpin de Crisse recommended in Essai sur l'art de la guerre. Justifying his strategy to William Pitt, Forbes suggested that Pitt consult Turpin's essay on the art of war to understand the theoretical principles on which he proceeded. Though Washington and Forbes did not always see eye to eye, Washington did appreciate his commander's knowledge of military literature. First published in French in 1754, Turpin's treatise was initially unavailable in English translation. So many excellent works of military theory and practice were written in the language that French became a required subject for first-year cadets once the military academy at West Point was established. Washington's inability to read French limited, or at least delayed, the development of his knowledge. He did not read the French treatises until they were rendered into English. Once Captain Joseph Otway translated Turpin as An Essay on the Art of War, in 1761, for instance, Washington acquired a copy for himself. A practical work detailing the operations of an army in the field, Turpin's essay is generally considered the best work on the art of war written in the 18th century. Turpin has a spirited yet intelligent and authoritative writing style. His tactical descriptions are marked by an extraordinary flexibility. He clearly understood that no two situations are the same. Officers needed to adjust both their strategy and their tactics to suit the moment. Though Washington's surviving copy of Turpin's essay has been rebacked, the rest of the original sprinkled calf binding survives, including its bookseller's label, sold by David Hall at the new printing office in Market Street, Philadelphia. Hall imported the London edition of Turpin's essay in 1763, at which time he advertised it for sale. It seems unlikely that Washington bought the book this early. It does not appear in the 1764 catalog of the Mount Vernon Library. Besides, he purchased virtually no military books between 1763 and 1774, that is, between the end of the Seven Years' War and the start of the Revolutionary War. Either someone else bought it from David Hall and Washington acquired it secondhand, or the work remained a part of David Hall's inventory until his death, and Washington purchased it from Hall and Sellers, the new partnership that David's son William Hall formed with William Sellers. Washington could have obtained his copy of Turpin's essay when he visited Philadelphia to attend the Continental Congress in 1775, the year he was appointed Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, but he may have obtained it the previous year when he was in the city for the first Continental Congress. Other evidence shows Washington expanding his military library after returning home from the first Continental Congress. In October 1774, he wrote William Milner, asking him to send a work he called Treatise on Military Discipline. Unsure which book Washington meant, Milner sent Thomas Webb's Military Treatise on the Appointments of the Army, a brief volume published in Philadelphia in 1759. Given the age of this work, in addition to the dissimilarity of its title, It seems unlikely that Webb's treatise was the one Washington intended, but, as he did with other books received by mistake, he added it to his library and learned what he could from it. An officer in the British Army, Webb had much to teach his readers. He had served with the Royal American Forces during the Seven Years' War. Severely wounded at Quebec, Webb had learned from experience that North America presented formidable challenges for the European soldier. He wrote his treatise to describe how to fight a war in the face of the unique topographical conditions of North America. Like Washington, Webb understood that since war in America differs significantly from war in Europe, officers must adjust their strategy and use different techniques to succeed. Webb also realized that the successful officer should be well-read. To know the art of war, one must know the history of war. His common sense reinforces an attitude toward reading akin to the one Washington had already established for himself. Webb observed, "It oftentimes happens in reading as it does in eating. He that eats the most is not always the most healthy, but he who eats sparingly of that which is good. So in reading, he who runs over the greatest number of books is not always the most sensible, but he who reads the best with clearness and perspicuity." Individual chapters of Webb's treatise discuss other topics: the importance of geography, the necessity of army engineer, the role of the artificer, the regulation of artillery. But Chapter 11, which specifically concerns forming a regiment for North America, is Webb's most original contribution to military strategy. He observed that North America largely consists of thick, woody country filled with mountains, swamps, and rivers, many of which were difficult or nearly impossible to cross. In contrast to the British troops, the French and their Indian allies were both equipped for and accustomed to the woods. For military success in North America, Webb argued, British officers must appoint lightly armed troops and adjust their marching style to suit the local terrain. The outbreak of the Revolutionary War at Lexington and Concord sparked a boom in the publication of military books. Everyone suddenly started reading them, including John Adams. The last week of May 1775, he wrote his wife from Philadelphia, "Oh, that I were a soldier! I will be. I am reading military books. Everyone must and will and shall be a soldier." Thomas Hansen's Prussian Evolutions in Actual Engagements, published by subscription that same year, was one work Adams read. So did Washington. Both men subscribed to its publication, as did many other American patriots: Benjamin Franklin, John Hancock, Richard Henry Lee, Peyton Randolph, and Anthony Wayne. Washington himself subscribed for 8 copies, apparently intending to distribute them to several of his officers. Hansen identified himself on his title page as adjutant to the 2nd Battalion and a teacher to the American militia. Little else is known of him, but his book constitutes a lasting legacy. Hansen subdivided Prussian Evolutions into 2 parts, the first discussing the infantry, the second devoted to the subject of gunnery. As a physical artifact, the book reflects the best and worst of the colonial printing industry. Issued by J. Douglas McDougall, a printer just starting out on his own, Prussian Evolutions contains a huge number of typographical errors, but its handsome illustrations, 30 engraved plates altogether, make it a noteworthy contribution to the art of printing in America. Most of the plates were engraved by John Hutt, but the opening one was engraved by John Norman, who would subsequently distinguish himself as the first engraver to attempt a portrait of George Washington. A mixture of patriotism and opportunism motivated the republication of other military manuals in 1775. Roger Stevenson's Military Instructions for Officers reflects both impulses. Stevenson's precise identity remains a mystery. Encyclopedist Abraham Rees held that Stevenson's military instructions reflected its author's military genius and the evident result of extensive experience. Though the title of Stevenson's work can be shortened to Military Instructions, the long title indicates its contents more precisely. Military Instructions for Officers Detached in the Field, containing a scheme for forming a corps of a partisan, illustrated with plans of the maneuvers necessary in carrying on the Petite Guerre. Whereas Bland gave contemporary readers information on drill and garrison duty, Stevenson offered practical instructions regarding an officer's duties in the field. Since detachments of regulars or partisan corps could conduct small-scale operations beneficial to their larger armies, all officers, Stevenson argued, should be familiar with the tactics of the Petite Guerre. His military instructions describe ambushing the enemy, attacking posts, constructing redoubts, defending entrenchments, establishing camps, marching with stealth, mounting a guard, patrolling at night, and reconnoitering enemy positions. J. A. Holding considers Stevenson's chapters on both attack and defense excellent, calling Military Instructions the single best work on the subject of the Petite Guerre to appear in the 18th century. The dedicatory epistle to the Philadelphia edition describes America as a country where every gentleman is a soldier and every soldier a student in the art of war. The editor recommends that officers in the Continental Army carry Stevenson's military instructions with them as a portable primer to the art of war. Its convenient size made the book a pocket volume to be consulted on any emergency. The empirical evidence shows that American officers took his advice. Before 1775 ended, its publisher, Robert Aitken, sold nearly 500 copies of the work. 2 years after its initial publication, he had sold over 800 copies total. Other evidence places Stevenson's military instructions in the hands of Washington's officers, according to Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Trying to locate a book about partisan warfare for his brother, Longfellow learned that Mr. Simon Greenleaf, the father of his friend James, owned the copy of Stevenson's military instructions that had belonged to Lieutenant Moses Greenleaf, Simon's father, who had served under Washington during the siege of Boston. Sending the book to his brother, Longfellow cautioned him to treat it gently because the volume had gone through the Revolution in the hands or pocket of Mr. Greenleaf's father. It is a precious relic and must be treated accordingly. Mr. Greenleaf says it is as precious to him as his father's sword would be. Besides indicating the importance of Stevenson's military instructions during the Revolutionary War, Longfellow's anecdote demonstrates the book's ongoing symbolic value long after the war had ended. Washington's financial accounts record that he purchased 5 military books on June 7, 1775. The fact that he bought these books the week before Congress appointed him Commander-in-Chief provides further evidence to demonstrate that Washington had a good idea Congress would make the appointment. Though he did not list any of the titles of these books in his financial accounts, a letter he wrote Colonel William Woodford of Virginia soon afterwards suggests what some of them were. Colonel Woodford had written to ask General Washington if he could recommend some good military books. Washington initially suggested Bland's Treatise of Military Discipline, emphasizing that Woodford should obtain the latest edition of the work. Washington's words of advice show he still smarted from his experience with the British merchant who had palmed off an old edition of Bland on him years earlier. Washington also recommended Turpin's Essay of the Art of War and Stevenson's Military Instructions. In addition, he recommended a book called The Partisan and another work he identified simply as Young. The Partisan, or The Art of Making War in Detachment, was a translation of a French work by Louis-Michel de Genet, a captain of Hungarian origin who served in the French army but about whom little else is known. De Genet elaborated the concept of the petite guerre, detailing how to fight in small, lightly armed detachments and describing methods of secret reconnaissance and surprise attack. Outlining an early form of guerrilla warfare, De Genet also related how to interdict enemy supply lines using light infantry. De Genet's work reinforced what Washington had learned during the Seven Years' War, especially during General Braddock's disastrous campaign against Fort Duquesne. By no means was Washington the only officer of the Continental Army to read The Partisan. De Genet's work was one of those titles Captain Ewald had turned up around 100 times in the knapsacks of American troops. Ewald's 100 knapsacks may seem like an exaggeration, but he was an authority on partisan warfare. The fact that Ewald would write a treatise on the subject based on his experiences during the Revolutionary War adds credence to his statement. By young, Washington meant Major William Young's Maneuvers or Practical Observations on the Art of War. Describing drill techniques, field tactics, and the fundamentals of the petite guerre, Young's Maneuvers contains little Washington could not find elsewhere. His copy of Young is historically significant because it survives with annotations in Washington's hand, which reveal how he read the work and what aspects of it he emphasized. To call Young's Maneuvers a separate work is somewhat misleading. It is actually a compilation of seven pamphlets published between 1766 and 1770, which Young collected and reissued with a common title page. In the order they appear in the volume, these titles are The Manual Exercise, An Essay on the Command of Small Detachments, A New System of Fortification, Young's edition of General Wolfe's Instructions to Young Officers, a collection of the regimental and general orders Wolfe issued in the decade before his death, which present the thoughts of a diligent and professional officer, Maneuvers for a Battalion of Infantry upon Fixed Principles, which constitutes an expanded version of the previous title with nearly twice as many illustrations, and The Practice of Maneuvering a Battalion of Infantry. As he did with other books, Washington corrected the errata in Young's Maneuvers, but his annotations in this volume go much further. Washington created a partial index for it, inscribing key topics and corresponding page numbers onto the blank leaves at the end of the volume. The first topic in Washington's manuscript index is On the Command of a Small Detachment, which indexes specific passages from the second pamphlet. The pages Washington indexed stress the importance of having a guide on a march, the value of a sufficient supply of food and water for a detachment, the way to construct redoubts, and the utility of practical military experience. Other entries in Washington's manuscript index refer to subjects covered in General Wolfe's Instructions to Young Officers, adjutants' duties, orders for the infantry in camp, orders for the infantry on the day of march, and quartermaster's orders. The passage on adjutants' duties that Washington indexed begins, Adjutants are to see all detachments before they are sent to the parade, that their arms be clean, their ammunition, accoutrements, etc. in good order, and that a sergeant be sent with them to the parade. The orders for behavior to follow in camp present rules for maintaining proper sanitary conditions. Wolfe's instructions for young officers advise that they should make themselves perfect masters of the exercise of the firelock, that they may be able to assist in training the young soldiers in arms. Perhaps it should come as no surprise that the first pamphlet in Young's Maneuvers to catch Washington's eye was the second pamphlet in the volume, An Essay on the Command of Small Detachments. An extraordinary continuity links together the works that formed Washington's Field Library. Most treat the subject, the Petite Guerre. Webb emphasizes the importance of using lightly armed troops in the American wilderness, and both Stevenson and Desgenais are devoted to the subject of partisan warfare. The Petite Guerre held a vital place in Washington's success over the British in the Revolutionary War. Though his field library is seldom discussed in biographies of him or histories of the war, the collection of books he assembled and carried with him throughout its duration emphasizes the strategic value of partisan warfare, which would be crucial to American success on the battlefield. Take the winter of 1776-77, for example. The victories of the Continental Army at Trenton and Princeton threw the British troops off balance. Though Howe consolidated his forces for greater security, he still faced the problem of getting sufficient forage for their horses. Whenever British regiments went into the field that winter, it seemed, Continental troops attacked them. The New Jersey militia was largely responsible for initiating this forage war, but Washington quickly understood that its success confirmed what he had read about the Petite Guerre in the books from his field library. He actively encouraged the militia to keep attacking small parties of British regulars. Though the size of the Continental Army dwindled significantly that winter, it remained large enough for it to use partisan warfare successfully. The comments of British officers who survived that New Jersey winter testify to the effectiveness of Washington's partisan warfare, which also served to embolden the Continental troops and reinforce their confidence. Writing to a correspondent the third week of February, Colonel Allen McLean observed, "The rebels have the whole winter gone upon a very prudent plan of constantly harassing our quarters with skirmishes and small parties, and always attacking our foraging parties. By this means they gradually accustom their men to look us in the face and stand fire, which they never dared to attempt in the field." The last week of March, Colonel Charles Stewart said that the Petite Guerre kept the army the whole winter in perpetual harassment. Captain Ewald found the partisan forces well nigh unstoppable. He wondered, "What can you do to those small bands who have learned to fight separate, who know how to use any molehill for their protection, and who, when attacked, run back as fast as they will approach you again, who continuously find space to hide? Never have I seen these maneuvers carried out better than by the American militia, especially by that of the province of Jersey." During the Forage War in New Jersey, American troops repeatedly defeated well-trained British regulars under many different conditions. The American soldiers' ability to dodge infantry fire, reconnoiter enemy positions, confiscate British armament, capture enemy forces, overcome natural and man-made obstacles, fight in both rural and urban environments, and know when to advance and when to retreat, demonstrated their mastery of the art of the Petite Guerre. The more he learned from his field library, the more books Washington acquired. His collection of military treatises grew so large that it became cumbersome to transport. Consequently, he ordered from Philadelphia joiner John Martin a special portable bookcase to hold his camp library. To protect his books, Washington instructed Martin to line the shelves of the bookcase with green baize. A coarse woolen fabric with a long nap often used to cover card tables, baize would cushion the books and protect them from damage during travel. Beyond a manuscript voucher indicating its purchase, Washington's green baize bookcase is not mentioned anywhere else in his surviving papers, but it is not difficult to surmise the whereabouts of this portable bookcase during the rest of the war. Once Washington received the bookcase from Martin, he filled it with his field library, which grew as the war continued. When Washington moved his military headquarters from one place to another, His green baize bookcase went with him. When the Continental Army went into winter quarters at Morristown, New Jersey, after the victory at Princeton, the bookcase was there. Despite the success of the Petite Guerre that winter, the Continental Army experienced crushing defeats, first at the Brandywine and then during the Battle of Germantown, which allowed the British to occupy Philadelphia. Washington brought the Continental Army into winter quarters at Valley Forge in December 1777. As he and his officers plotted strategy in a stone farmhouse during that freezing cold Valley Forge winter, the green baize bookcase was there. When American troops battled the British to a standstill at Monmouth on June 28, 1778, the longest, hottest day of the war, his military library was nearby. When Washington returned to Morristown in 1779 to establish his winter quarters, he brought his camp library with him. Perhaps the corners of that cloth-covered bookcase were becoming as bumped and rubbed as the corners of the books they contained, but it sturdily performed the function for which it was built. Not all the military books in Washington's field library were practical manuals. In 1780, David Humphreys, then serving as aide-de-camp to General Nathanael Greene, wrote a poem praising the American cause and celebrating its military heroes. Printed at New Haven, the 16-page work appeared under the title A Poem Addressed to the Armies of the United States of America. Humphreys presented a copy to General Washington and sent one to Martha Washington, too. Speaking of Washington in this poem, Humphreys wrote, "His martial skill our rising armies formed, his patriot zeal their generous bosoms warmed, his voice inspired, his godlike presence led, the Britons saw and from his presence fled." The overblown rhetoric and highfalutin diction make the poem seem quite dated now, but Humphreys was working within the neoclassical poetic conventions of the 18th century, and General Washington was impressed. A month after Washington received the poem, Humphreys was transferred to his command. His service as Washington's aide-de-camp began a friendship that would last a lifetime. After Comte de Rochambeau landed at Newport, Rhode Island in 1780 in charge of a French expeditionary force of over 5,000 troops, he presented Washington with a copy of Drummond de Melfort's Traité sur Cavalerie, which also became a part of Washington's military library. Consisting of a large folio volume with an even larger volume of plates, it might have been too big to fit within his bookcase. Nevertheless, Washington kept it with him instead of sending it back to Mount Vernon. Having established winter quarters at New Windsor, New York, in December 1780, Washington received a visit from the Marquis de Chastellux, a high-ranking French officer who took advantage of the season to travel through North America. Their dinner conversation turned to military literature, and Washington, according to Chastellux, expressed his appreciation of French writings on the subject. The dinner was excellent. Tea succeeded dinner, and conversation succeeded tea and lasted till supper. War was frequently the subject. On asking the general which of our professional books he read with most pleasure, he answered me that they were the King of Prussia's Instruction to His Generals and the Tactics of Monsieur de Guibert, from which I concluded that he knew as well how to select his authors as to profit by them. Though detailed, Chastellux's account is not necessarily accurate. Washington could have read the King of Prussia's Military Instructions, which had been translated into English in 1762. It, too, offered information about partisan warfare, as it provided the King of Prussia's instructions for the use of lightly armed infantry. Washington would not have read Comte de Guibert's Essai Général de Tactique unless he had hired someone to translate it for him. An English translation of Guibert's essay on military tactics would not be published until the following year. Instead of Guibert, Washington might have meant General de Grandmaison's treatise on the military service of light horse and light infantry. Robert Bell had published Louis Nicolas' English translation of Grandmaison in 1777. Captain Ewald frequently found copies of both the King of Prussia's military instructions and Grandmaison's treatise on the military service in the knapsacks of American officers. When Washington and Rochambeau traveled from Connecticut to Yorktown in 1781, Washington stopped at Mount Vernon on the way, the first time he had been home since leaving to attend the Second Continental Congress in 1775. Though he still carried his camp library with him, he did not leave any part of it at Mount Vernon. That green baize bookcase stood close at hand during the siege of Yorktown. After his brilliant victory there, which effectively ended any British hope of winning the war, Washington traveled to Philadelphia to confer with Congress. During the winter of 1781-82, General Washington established headquarters at Newburgh, New York, on the Hudson River north of West Point, and his green baize bookcase came with him. He would keep it by his side until the end of the war.